Hello, this is Green Philosophy with Mark Abel, and here we are live with author, environmentalist, and activist Derek Jensen. How are you today, Derek?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm very well. And how long have you been involved with activism?
Probably since 30 years. Probably since 89. I was in my late 20s, and from a little bit before that, I was probably sort of unofficially from probably 86, and then I started working with some groups up in Washington State in 89, working with John Osborne, and then the what used to be the Inland Empire Public Lands Council. And before that, I had done some sporadic stuff, you know, participated in anti-fur demos, anti-military demos. But when I really started getting into it was in 89.
So you said something along the lines of many activists begin with trying to protect a particular piece of land, and then later on in their journey, they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Can you expand upon that a little more?
Yeah, that was actually one of John Osborne's lines. And it's like there was this one guy that I worked with, Barry Rosenberg, who started his activism because he was a back-to-the-lander back in the 70s, and then the Forest Service clear-cut the spring that was their water supply. They clear-cut around it, and it destroyed their water supply. And there are just so many people, environmental activists, who started by, you know, there was a particular place they loved that was being destroyed, and they would start to try to do something about that, and then that would lead to the question of, so why are these places being destroyed? And that would often lead to the answer to, because it makes money. And then they would, that would lead to the question of why would you destroy a place? Why would you have an economic system that is set up to make money off of destroying the land base? And then that would lead to, so have there been other cultures who have not lived this way and have not destroyed their land base? And this would also lead to the question of, has this culture always destroyed land bases? And, you know, you see the same thing with, with women who might start doing their activism because they themselves or someone they care about was sexually assaulted. And so they start asking, and first off, they just want to stop that. And then they start asking, so why do men rape? And then they start asking, have men raped in every culture? And you find out from Peggy Reeve Sanday that there are high and low rape cultures. It's like, so what are the characteristics? Which Peggy Reeve Sanday talks about. And so it's very, you know, we as environmentalists or we as whatever sort of activists we are can spend a lot of time fighting particular fires, and a lot of people spend their entire lives doing that, but there are other people who start off fighting particular fires and then start asking why some jerk keeps setting fires. And, excuse me. So that's sort of a little bit of an expansion on that statement.
So Henry David Thoreau and Walden had a little tongue-in-cheek statement where he said that European Americans are very obsessed with fashion, and fashion is always evolving. And he said he felt that no honest occupation begins with the need to change your clothes. And that actually ended up being the basis for a novel and movie, Devil Wears Prada. But anyway, he continued with that he respected indigenous people who got heavily tattooed because they committed to a design. So, how does fashion relate to capitalism, ecological destruction?
Well, that's interesting. I had no idea, which I've never seen the Devil Wears Prada, but I had no idea that was based on Henry David Thoreau quote. That's pretty cool, actually. Anyway, you know, I'm not an expert on fashion at all, but I have been taught by some activists who do work on, who have worked on feminist issues, like Leah Keith, that one of the reasons that fashion was invented was to, or fashion was promoted so much, was because otherwise people were going to wear out their clothes. And how do you get them to buy new clothes? Well, you tell them that the old ones are not fashionable. And I think about this actually quite a lot because I have this weird thing. It shouldn't be very weird at all. This weird thing where I like to wear out clothes. Like I'll wear clothes until they are, I mean, I'll do what people used to do, which is I wear clothes until they're basically rags. And then at that point, I will turn the rags, I mean, I'll cut them into rags and then I use them more. That's what everybody used to do through all time. But, if you can convince people to buy new clothes every year because the old clothes are out of fashion, then that's
obviously a way to sell.
So it's a form of planned obsolescence is really the short version of what I'm trying to say. It's like this, you know, I'm known for wearing these sweaters that my mom put these designs on, and this is one of the newer ones. You know, my mom died a year and a half ago. This is one of the newer ones, and it's probably 6 or 7 years old. But I still look at it as, oh, this is the new one. And I think about this sometimes with shirts that, like, I'll put on a particular shirt.
Oh yeah, this is
one of my new shirts. I only got it 20 years ago.
And I mean.
So yeah, it's pretty clear. It's a form of planned obsolescence. That's the short answer.
Now, one irony about this, so. My father happens to be a Princeton man and a Harvard man, and I consider him kind of that old WASP establishment, or otherwise known as, you know, he's a preppy. And one thing I've noticed about him is he bought these Shetland wool sweaters and Shetland wool sport coats, 30 and 40 years ago, and he just wears those every day with an Oxford dress shirt and a pair of shoes made in Italy 40 or 50 years ago, and he keeps getting them resold. And I think what's ironic here of consumerism and planned obsolescence is that, you know, the Puritan forebears of this country were very much against waste, and they were very much about reuse of things.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And obviously, we aren't there. And
If you'll hold on for a second,
I'm going to try to find an actual number on
this, because I know
in the books that we have coming out next year, we wrote a little bit about clothes, and there's just a couple numbers that are just
pretty stunning.
I hope I can find them quickly enough that this doesn't become
a waste of time.
I should be able to find it. There's only 19 places where we said cloth.
In the United States,
in 2012, the average person in the United States purchased 64 items of clothing per year,
which corresponds to the throwaway rate.
More than 60 pounds of textiles per person per year.
There's about 15% of that flood ends up at thrift stores, most of which ends up not getting sold.
There's a single Salvation Army store in New York City that yields 6 tons of excess clothing every day.
The majority of that is compressed into bales and exported mostly to sub-Saharan Africa.
And clothing that won't sell there goes into industrial rags production facilities.
And it's also very interesting because clothes are cheaper.
In 1901, the average American household spent about 14% of its income on clothing, and today the number is closer to 3%. As that proportion has declined, so has the average person's skill in sewing and so has the ability of tailors to make a living. And what this
ever more in a throwaway culture,
in a throwaway economy.
And even worse, you know,
and even worse, you know, at one point, even if they would have been throwing away all this
clothing, it still would have been made, natural materials,
cotton or whatever, that would eventually go back to the earth.
And nowadays,
a good percentage of it is made with various forms of plastic.
And that creates tremendous problems when it gets eventually trashed.
So, speaking to that, one thing I'm seeing, you probably aren't familiar with the hipster scene in a lot of cities, you know, Hamilton, Toronto, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland. But I'm familiar with what the 25-year-olds and what the 30-year-olds are wearing. And the thing that is catching on now is some pretty expensive jeans, anywhere from $100 to $300 a pair. And the fabric's from Japan, and they're often sewn in either Japan, England, or Canada. So it's not sweatshop clothes. It's kind of boutique, raw denim. There are these jeans that you wash maybe once every 4 weeks or every 6 weeks, and it's kind of extra care. You put it in woolite, you put it in your bathtub in cold water, and you hang dry. And we're seeing a little more of a transition, or these $300 Wolverine 1,000-mile boots, lifetime warranty. Again, it's bourgeois, and I recognize that, you know, only privileged people will have access to some of these higher quality things that can last for more years, which kind of shows the fundamental flaw of capitalism today, is that you have quality, well-made products for a small minority of society and disposable, mass-produced for everyone else.
Well, we have that same problem. Well,
we have that same problem with
organic foods.
I mean, it's crazy that prior to 1940, basically all food was organic.
Because they hadn't really invented pesticides and artificial fertilizers. Maybe take that back 10 years earlier, whatever. And nowadays you can buy organic, but it costs you more.
It's a very damning indictment of the food production system.
When you have to pay extra to not have poison on your food.
One sec. Let's just see if this is. Oh, you're cutting out. Okay, you're back. Let's see. Am I back? Yours.
I can see you. You're fine.
You're fine.
Oh, you can see me? Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
So, I think you have critiqued civilization. I would name you an anti-civilization theorist like Jared Diamond. I think your work has an anarchist undercurrent, although you probably wouldn't label yourself as an anarchist. How does your work situate into the field of modern anarchism as a whole?
Well, it's a tough question because a few years ago that hasn't been published yet, about what I perceive to be a fairly big split, sort of a big conflict over the soul and direction of anarchism. And it's between those who perceive that those in power make laws primarily to benefit those in power. One of the primary purposes of government is to facilitate resource extraction of whatever form, to facilitate commerce. And there's a lot of old school anarchists, Chomsky, Edward Abbey, who would probably fall into this category.
And in fact, there are a lot of people who would fall into this category. At talks, I have literally asked thousands and thousands of people over the decades, do you believe the government takes better care, or any government,
takes better care of human beings or corporations.
And nobody, not a
single person has ever said it takes better care of human beings.
So we all recognize
that the government takes better care of corporations than it does
actual living beings.
And we could get into a nice discussion of
Lewis Mumford
and authoritarian techniques on that direction if you want. But as the present topic, so there's
one camp of anarchist
in which I could
safely place myself,
if I wanted to place myself in any camp of
people who
recognize that
governments exist to
take care of the powerful primarily.
And then on the other hand, you have
anarchists who believe that because
laws are made by and
for those in power,
therefore
all social restrictions on our behavior
are
inherently oppressive.
And I find that perspective frankly appalling.
Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed has,
because of this, promoted pedophilia.
People like Hakeem Bey promoting pedophilia.
Bestiality. Who argue that
because strictures against homosexuality are wrong,
therefore all strictures against all forms of sexuality are wrong.
And this
strain of anarchism,
that believes that all social
restrictions
are inherently oppressive.
It
goes all the way back to Diogenes, who many people consider the first Western anarchist.
So where do I situate myself in modern anarchism?
I don't know.
That's the long answer is the one I just gave you.
The short answer is
I don't really worry about that so much because I just write my books.
And
other people can situate me wherever they want.
Either in anarchism or out of anarchism, it doesn't really matter.
Early on in my career, back when I used to read reviews, which I only read for the first book or two.
Anyway, somebody in a review said this pretty smart thing. They said
that at some point in his career,
everybody is going to hate Derek Jensen because
they will love
that he wrote this thing here,
but they're going to hate that he wrote this thing over here.
And it's because
he refuses to just follow any ideological line. And instead,
switching from third to first person,
I just follow wherever the books take me.
And there were people who absolutely loved language older than words who then hated me for culture make believe.
And there were people who loved language and culture who then absolutely hated Endgame.
And oh well.
So, with regard to the anarchists that think that strictures on any personal behavior are illegitimate, I just got finished with a Netflix series. It's called Dope, and it kind of painted the United States and other countries as a modern day Wild Wild West with regard to the drug trade. It was some of these drug dealers could make upwards of, you know, $500,000 per year. Some of them would make $10,000 in a day. And many of the drugs, you know, the cocaine, I guess, isn't a major concern for me in the sense that the purer stuff, you can take it, you can go dancing, you can have sex, you can have a great time, and you know, it can damage you, but the really scary stuff is the crystal meth, which keeps you awake for 5 days straight. The fentanyl, which is 50 times the potency of heroin. And, you know, people can get away with maybe being, you know, shooting up heroin for 5 or 10 years, and they have an idea of how much their body can handle. But when it comes to the fentanyl, is you shoot slightly more than your body can handle, you're in a body bag. And another one was meth, which keeps the users up 4 or 5 days as well, and, you know, rots out their teeth and their body kind of disintegrates from the inside out. Now, that made me question, you know, some of my libertarian views on drugs should just be completely legal, because I personally, I don't want to live in a community or a neighborhood or a housing development full of people that are zonked out on these substances. It's kind of like The Walking Dead. I don't know, what are some sensible ways to view the drug war?
Well, it's interesting.
Well, it's interesting. So far as the libertarian perspective, just the other day, I happened to see a video from the 2016 Florida libertarian presidential debate where one of the candidates, I don't remember which one, said, you know, he's a libertarian, obviously.
But he said that he believed that there should be laws that you should not be allowed to sell heroin to a six-year-old. And there were some people in the audience who booed him. Which obviously they're taking an extreme libertarian stance.
And I think the important thing to recognize, whether we're talking about drugs or forms of sexuality or any behavior,
is that humans are social creatures. And we evolve in relationship with others.
In relationship with a community.
And we have to ask about whatever behavior we do. Not only is this good for me, but we ask, is this good for the community?
And that's what being an adult is.
And I love the statement by Craig O'Hara, he's an anarchist. About how he believes that anarchism doesn't mean no laws.
The goal of anarchism is to make it so we don't need laws because we've evolved society such that those laws are no longer necessary.
But in the meantime, every culture that's ever existed has had strictures against some forms of killing.
If you take a libertarian perspective to an extreme,
well, you've got predatory capitalism is what you've got.
It is okay to say as a society that it is not okay for you to, or for me to, it doesn't matter, I'm not attacking you, for any of us to kill our neighbor without sufficient cause.
And I'm adding without sufficient cause because obviously if my neighbor is coming over and attacking me with a gun, it's certainly okay for me to shoot back at him. But for me to walk over and just bash my neighbor in the back of the head with a hammer, that's not okay. And you're looking uncomfortable, like there's a problem with this, and that's okay if you want to disagree about this.
But all I'm saying is, with the drug war or with drugs.
It's interesting that you bring this question up too, because the book I'm working on right now is about how marijuana legalization is destroying the marijuana culture that evolved in Northern California.
And marijuana legalization, as it's been implemented, has been basically a transfer of wealth away from family farmers to big conglomerates. At this point, there are, I think, four economic entities that control almost all the marijuana in Colorado, and the same thing has happened with Washington and Oregon. Same thing's happening in California.
The whole thing has been about a transfer of wealth away from it.
I live in Northern California. And there are so many people who basically have been able to
make their living
by doing a
by doing a very small growth.
And that has been
an interesting exploration of how communities work without
laws, too.
Because obviously when it was illegal,
if somebody rips you off,
you know, you can't go to the cops.
And
so it's been
very interesting because there is a subculture within this marijuana subculture
that is
everybody I know who has participated in marijuana culture has been ripped off more times than they can count.
And there are times where they make a decent living, and there are times where they just get ripped off again and again and again. And
this
and as a consequence, there are people in marijuana culture.
Okay,
I'll give you a real example. There was a guy who
I was talking to
probably a month and a half ago who
who has a friend.
He doesn't do this, but his friend
has
a grow
that happens to be
near,
a
homeless meth encounter.
You with me so far?
You with me so far?
So he's growing outside.
And there is a homeless meth encampment with a bunch of meth addicts.
I don't know, quarter mile, half mile, from where,
I don't know how far, but close to where he is.
And I said,
how do you keep from getting ripped off all the time?
And
I'm just reporting this. I am not saying this is right. I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm just saying this is what happens.
He said, well, what you do
is you watch very carefully, and the first one that comes in,
you beat him,
and you beat him good.
And then you tell him to go back and tell all his friends.
This is what's going to happen to every one of you who comes in here.
He said it works.
Again, I'm not saying that's okay.
And
I mean, we know that the cops...
Ultimately, what underlies
if somebody broke into your house right now, or not now, but when you're gone and then stole everything you had, and then you call the cops,
we know that the authority
of the cops ultimately rests on force too.
And you know,
this brings up
something that for me
is at the core of the difficulty
in anarchism.
And the core of the difficulty
in living on the planet at all,
which is
how do you respond to sociopaths?
And we can go back to drugs. And we can go back to drugs in a second.
But this is I just find really important that
what do you do? How do you deal with?
This is a big problem, especially,
well, it's a big problem all over, but in anarchism it's a big problem in part because
anarchism is essentially open membership.
And one becomes an anarchist by saying, hey, I'm an anarchist.
And
that's,
here, I'm gonna
find some lines from one anarchist I was talking to about this and just read what he said because what he said was just absolutely perfect.
I'll find it pretty quick. Okay.
Excuse me.
This was all from a person who I'll just read it.
It's a couple paragraphs.
Today, it was a while ago.
I spoke with an extremely well-known anarchist who's a decent person,
and he does not perpetrate or promote community-destroying behavior. Really good guy. He told me he believes that anarchism, while flawed, is worth saving. I see a few problems with anarchism, he said.
The first is that it's a very small movement.
So
And so while there will be nutters in any movement,
in anarchism, their influence on both the movement and public perception will be magnified.
I'm sure there are complete nutters in the Democratic and Republican parties and the Sierra Club, and for that matter, amongst stamp collectors and chess players.
But anarchism is much smaller, which makes the obnoxious outliers all the more obvious. The next problem is there are some strains of anarchism, and he's talking about the extreme libertarian ones, as opposed to communitarian ones, that encourage community-destroying behavior.
These strains will draw an even more disproportionate percentage of nutters and will cultivate them to the detriment of all and to the detriment of anarchism as a whole.
The third problem is that anarchism is perceived by many as a self-definition.
Someone becomes an anarchist by simply declaring he or she is an anarchist.
That means that among a lot of self-declared anarchists, anarchism can mean whatever they want it to mean, which means it doesn't really mean anything at all.
I don't agree with this, he said, and I don't believe that a lot of people who call themselves anarchists actually are.
I believe anarchism has a very specific meaning in a long tradition of resistance to empire and a long tradition of working for communities, and I don't want to give up on that tradition just because a bunch of nutters are causing problems.
But there we run into another problem with anarchism, which is that it's an open membership by which I mean there really isn't a process by which we can kick people out who are harming others, who are harming anarchism.
And any anarchist who does try to get the nutters to behave is immediately labeled a fascist or worse.
That's a terrible problem in anarchism, and one we need to resolve.
And so why I come back to that is... The question that we need to answer, if we want to survive on this planet,
this is not just a problem in anarchism.
This is a problem in general, how do we deal with sociopathic cultures?
So the analysis that I've followed forever is that totalitarian agriculture is converting the entire land base to human use.
The advantage of that is that once you convert it to human use, you can grow more human, who can make a standing army, among other things.
The disadvantage, apart from the fact that you're being sociopathological by killing off everybody else who lives there,
is that this will permanently reduce the carrying capacity of your land.
Which means that after you've expanded and you've made this big army, now your land is going to get degraded, and you will either need to collapse or you'll need to conquer somebody else.
And the bad news is that if you do want to conquer somebody else, you have a competitive advantage because you have destroyed your land base to make an army.
And so that's why various civilizations have conquered their way across the land base.
That's why the dominant civilization has conquered its way across the planet. And we need to figure out how to deal with that quickly because it's running out of planet.
And in terms of anarchism, this is a line I've been saying for years, is that if the anarchists can't figure out how to deal with the sociopaths who insinuate themselves into anarchism.
How are they going to deal with the sociopaths who run capitalism?
And we need to figure out, again, whether we want to say we anarchists or whether we want to say anybody on the planet, need to figure out what to do about that. And I don't think we've come up with a good answer, but obviously we haven't come up with a good answer,
or the culture would be killing the planet.
So Derek, I just completed
and,
a.
Wait, I want to take it back to drugs.
This is a problem in the marijuana community too.
And again, I know this community really well, living here.
I mean, it's so weird, even before legalization, you could be standing in the grocery store behind somebody in line,
and you'll be hearing him talk about the grow-off.
It's just everywhere. Turkey bags are really central to the whole marijuana culture out here. They hold about a pound a pot. You can close them up and they hold the scent pretty well.
The culture out here runs on turky bags.
And this is the only place I've ever lived where you can see billboards advertising turkey bags.
It's like that's how common marijuana culture is here.
One out of every five houses in Arcata prior to legalization was a grow house.
Anyway, so it's very common.
Marijuana culture itself did not ever figure out a way to deal with the sociopaths.
There are individuals
who
form form really close relationships
that will go 30 years with an individual grower, with a wholesaler, with a distributor, with a seller, with some customers.
And there are those who have established long-term good relationships where they're all recognizing
that they're all benefiting.
And
at the same time,
I literally know people who have outdoor grows
who literally have to take a shotgun with them when they go to the outhouse
because they have had to use it coming out of the outhouse to chase away robbers.
I mean,
it's kind of horrifying too. So this is not an abstract sort of, let's talk about anarchist theory.
I see this played out among people I know who don't have any background in anarchist theory, who've had to try to navigate how to navigate these interactions given that, in this case, calling the cops.
You don't have the cops as a sort of overarching umbrella that you can run to to protect yourself.
So they are sort of, sorry about going on so long, but I find it really interesting that they are sort of perforce.
I mean, they're sort of forced into an anarchistic situation without any anarchist. Because it is literally self-governance, is what I'm trying to get at. With some great stuff too. There's some great stuff about this self-governance because you'll notice when the state has taken this over, it's basically handed it over to the oligarchs. So there was tremendous opportunity. I want to say one more thing, which is that one reason that legality has been a disaster is that illegality was a barrier to economies of scale. By which I mean that now, since it's legal, you can have entire city blocks devoted to greenhouses, and it's obviously cheaper to grow if you have a larger operation, your buy unit costs are less.
And that was not possible back when it was all illegal.
So it was perforce, a small-scale, decentralized, community-based, commodity-based enterprise. There's the word I'm looking for.
And I'm just rambling because I don't really have an answer to any of this.
I agree with that one libertarian that you should not be allowed to sell heroin to a six-year-old. I want to say one more thing.
In the book I'm working on, I do an exploration of smuggling and the morality of smuggling.
And there are some circumstances where smuggling is great. For example, there was a woman, Irina Sedler, who smuggled children out of the Warsaw Ghetto and smuggled medicine in.
That's wonderful.
That's great.
At the same time, there are, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but something like millions of children smuggled every year for exploitation, either sexual or labor.
I think that the people who smuggle children should be shot in the head.
Smuggle children for sexual exploitation, not Irina Sedler.
So the point is that there are some people who would say that the answer to all these questions is to get rid of all the laws. But I think there's actually good reason for a community to say we don't want to export salmon from this stream because the salmon in this stream cannot support the infinite demand of a global economy.
That's perfectly acceptable for a community to set those rules.
That's perfectly acceptable for a community to set rules saying,
I mean, whatever your position,
whatever other position you have on
heroin,
I think it's perfectly acceptable
for a community to say, no, you can't give heroin to a child unless they have cancer and they need it for pain relief.
So, Derek, you bring up so many good points, and I'm just completing a course on European geography, and finishing the course made me realize your idea where you said that cities depend on the importation of resources from somewhere else. And for a long time, I probably would have considered myself, a liberal Marxist, social Democrat. Why don't we just implement Scandinavian-type social welfare policies and tame capitalism? And, I know the data from, places like Tree Hugger or The Guardian, they'll say things along the lines of, your average Western European is using a third of the energy of an American or a Canadian, and they have a good lifestyle. They have 6 weeks of paid vacation. They have general prosperity, a large middle class, a small class of people in poverty. And a lot of Western liberals think, oh, social democracy is good enough. But my finishing this European geography course and your book Endgame makes me recognize that the irony of Western Europe today is that they have probably the best environmental regulation of the capitalists, compared to South America, compared to United States, compared to Canada, compared to Asia, compared to India. But that said, when you talked about a community a community should be able to self-regulate. Norway decided to not join the European Union because they wanted to keep their agricultural subsidies. Switzerland chose to not join the European Union because they didn't want environmental degradation. Iceland chose to not join the European Union because they thought that their fishing hunting grounds would get destroyed. So I think more discussions of how environmental sustainability can contribute to policy among nations is useful. But back to the course. So I had never heard of – did you ever hear of Sweden? S-W-I-D-D-E-N. That was the slash-and-burn agriculture of – kind of like the Celtic era, like the Angles, the Saxons, they would basically burn land to create, they would burn down forests to create agricultural land, and then later on, the forests were unable to grow back, and the land that was damaged became wetlands. The wetlands couldn't really be used for agriculture, thus more forests had to be burned and slashed for more agricultural land. And then the Roman Empire eviscerated, you've said this a lot in your lectures, that the Roman Empire eviscerated the land base of the Middle East. And then I guess I was surprised to hear that Europe today, they're the most, they're the highest population density in the world, these Western European countries. I think Paris is almost 70,000 people per square mile. Wow. And the only way that Paris can feed themselves, back to your concept of cities depend on importation of outside resources, is agribusiness in the United States, Cargill Hill, Monsanto, the rich agricultural surplus of the Midwest, your Indiana, your Iowa, your Great Plains states, plus the agricultural surplus of South American countries, Argentina or Venezuela or other South American countries. That's what allows Europe to feed itself. I guess the irony in all this is Western European, they do have, your Germany's, your Italy, your Spain, your Denmark, your Sweden, your Finland, your Iceland. They do have the most stringent environmental protections on the books, but because of their population density, they're not sustainable in the sense of not being able to feed themselves.
Yeah, and they're in many ways simply exporting the harm. Oh, and just to let you know, I've got 148 here, and I have another appointment at two.
So I'm gonna have to wrap up at 158.
So that's perfectly fine.
Anyway, back to this point, there are those anti-environmentalists who have argued that environmental protection is a luxury, and that the only reason the United States can protect national parks or wilderness areas is because it's a wealthy country, and unfortunately the anti-environmentalists are wrong.
It's not a luxury; it's a necessity.
But they're right in that the reason the United States has been able to set aside these lands and have whatever rules it does is because it has been pillaging all across the world. And we see this today, by the way, also with carbon emissions.
The carbon emissions in the United States.
They talk about, oh, let's reduce them a little bit.
We have to try to reduce them.
But carbon emissions are counted in the country where they are actually emitted.
So when anybody in the United States buys anything that's made in China,
China gets the hit for the carbon emissions in terms of the accounting.
And so, somebody said quite a while ago that basically Walmart is one of the export arms of the Chinese economy.
And this is not a specific attack on Walmart.
It's just another example of what you're talking about.
So here's the thing. My niece and her husband and kids came to visit my mom, and at one point we had to go to Walmart to get something because Walmart had basically destroyed all the other stores in town.
We had to go to Walmart, and as we're standing in the parking lot of Walmart, my niece's husband, who is Chinese, said, you know,
In my lifetime, the skies have gone from blue to gray to brown to black, and it's also people around the world can have Chinese manufactured goods.
And it's great for the economy, but the sky has turned black in my lifetime.
And he's not even particularly conservative. I'm not conservative. He's not particularly environmentalist.
He's just making an observation.
This is a long way of just agreeing with what you just said.
So in the textbook from my professor, I believe it was written from a industrialist Eurocentric perspective. And the reason I say that was they talked about how the Eastern European countries thought that economic development was more important than environmental protections. And they also talk about how it's kind of consistent with maybe the Marxist productionist ethos that we're told that history is linear. We're going from the cavemen to a colony on Mars, and progress is linear, and we went from barbaric Germanic tribes and early agriculture to industrialization to the knowledge economy. And we're told that progress is linear when really we've desecrated the environment more substantially since the Industrial Revolution than ever before. And I guess, are you familiar with David McCullough? Has a new book about settling the American West and eviscerating the Indians, and I guess we can tie this all together of how is the history curriculum industrialization centric? How is the history curriculum European American centric?
Well, I think you answered.
Well, I think you answered your own question with.
They believe that progress is
not only forward moving.